You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show...
As long as El-Sisi is with us, we are with him. One hand, says this voter. I am stronger and safer when I vote for El-Sisi.
They're voting in Cairo for all the difference it's likely to make. They have voted in Europe and parts of Ukraine. We'll be reviewing the day's top news stories with Mary Dajewski and Matthew Jameson here in the studio. Then we'll be asking the people behind the Herb Lester travel guides to talk us through their new book about London pubs.
We've given these chapters your occasions, so, you know, as a Patrick Hamilton section. So if you really love Patrick Hamilton books and you want to sit in a really, really mournful pub in the middle of the West End on a Wednesday afternoon, you're not really going to get that specific a recommendation in other books.
All that, plus a check-in with our man in Montreal. We'll be reviewing the latest art exhibitions in Berlin, and we might even play a song or two. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right here on Monocle 24 right now. Lots coming up, as ever, in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest news.
At least 40 people have been killed and 150 more injured in a train crash in the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. The accident happened when an express passenger train ran into a stationary goods train near a station 150 miles from the state capital, Lucknow. Arendra Kumar is the chairman of the Indian Railway Board.
Medical relief is in full operation, the rescue and reliefs are also in full operation at the peak level, and the position is being constantly monitored from the ministry also, and there are indications of casualties, but the exact number has not yet been possible to be confirmed.
In the United States, the man who killed six people in a California college town emailed his deadly plans minutes before he went on a rampage, sending his parents racing to try to stop him. Elliot Roger, 22-year-old son of a Hollywood director, stabbed three people to death in his flat before gunning down three more victims on Friday night in the town of Isla Vista near the campus of the University of California at Santa Barbara. He then shot himself. Andy Jang lives in the same apartment complex as Roger and heard the shots.
When the thing happened, I was playing video games inside, and I was playing, like, shooter game, and I thought the gunshots were from the video game. And when I went outside, there were a lot of cop cars, and, like, police just, you know, just coming, like, just at least, like, I counted at least 15 or 20 of them. Like, there were a lot of cops coming, and that's when I realized that, like, someone actually got shot.
One victim's father has today blamed the killings on politicians who failed to tighten gun laws after a mass school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. The FIFA president Sepp Blatter has met with the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas and the head of the Palestinian Football Association Jibril Rajoub on Monday, ahead of next month's FIFA Congress, when Palestinians said they would urge delegates to take sanctions against Israel. Palestinians say Israeli security forces who control movement between the Gaza Strip and the Israeli-occupied West Bank frequently prevent athletes from travelling freely between the two separated territories. Israel cites security concerns but says it has eased travel for athletes between the Palestinian territories. Stunning victories in European Parliament elections by nationalist Eurosceptic parties from France and Britain has left the European Union licking its wounds today and facing a giant policy dilemma. Across the continent, anti-establishment parties more than doubled their representation, harnessing a mood of anger with Brussels over austerity, mass unemployment and immigration. Of the mainstream parties, the former Luxembourg Prime Minister and leading candidate of the European People's Party, Jean-Claude Juncker, claimed the right to lead the European Commission and said he should replace Portugal's José Manuel Barroso, as moderate centre-right parties were expected to come first in the elections.
As we did win these elections, I feel fully entitled to become the next president of the European Commission. This was not the only issue about when the Europeans went to polls today, but it's a particular issue provoking some interest, as far as I'm concerned, and so I'm very happy about this result.
And finally, staying with election news, and Narendra Modi has been sworn in as India's Prime Minister today in an elaborate ceremony at New Delhi's resplendent presidential palace after a sweeping general election victory that ended two terms of rule by the Nehru Gandhi dynasty. Millions of Indians watched the inauguration live on television. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House. It's 18:05 here in London. We will be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 in London, which is 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news in the studio is the journalist Mary Dejevsky, who focuses on Russia, the EU and the US, and is the chief editorial writer and a columnist at The Independent. And also with me is Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at the London-based defence think tank, the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both to the programme. We shall start tonight in Ukraine, which 3 months ago ousted a billionaire plutocrat president and has over the weekend elected a billionaire plutocrat president. Ukraine's new head of state is Petro Poroshenko, a confectionery baron who has previously held other senior cabinet posts. Mr. Poroshenko, President Poroshenko, as I guess he now is, President-elect Poroshenko, says he wants to end war and bring peace, which I guess is better than the other way around. Do we like his chances? Mary Dejevsky, I'll ask you first.
Well, his chances look a bit better today than they did, say, a week ago, because he has quite a big majority. He won a convincing victory, and the threatened boycott in eastern Ukraine did happen, but not nearly on the scale that was feared. So he is in a better position to bring peace than maybe anybody else in Ukraine, which may not be saying much.
And just sticking with you, Mary, on that point, they reported a 60% turnout nationwide, which is quite decent going, but there is or was a lot of abstention for one reason or another in the east. There wasn't even a single polling station open in Donetsk, according to some reports. I guess the question is, especially also in Donetsk today, we're hearing reports of quite heavy fighting around the airport. He says he wants to bring peace. Is this metaphor going to come off? Probably not. But is the toothpaste of war out of the tube?
Well, over the last 2 weeks, it certainly looked like that. It looked as though there might be no going back at all, and that the brink of civil war had actually escalated to the point of no return. Now, after an election which is more successful, I think, than a lot of people thought it would be, I think there is half a chance, but only half a chance. And maybe the good thing, although it doesn't look like that now, is that the violence currently, such as it is localized around Donetsk. So if you look at East Ukraine generally, it's more peaceful than it has been for several weeks.
President-elect Poroshenko says he's going to visit the Donbass region, which is one thing. Matthew Jameson, what should he say when he gets there?
I think that now is the moment for the new president to try to be a unifying figure and to bring the country together. So he has got to make clear that this is a Ukraine that welcomes everyone, and that it is a Ukraine that can be united but can also be diverse and a home for those who may feel a greater affinity with Russia. So I think he will have to strike a very conciliatory note, an inclusive note, but also he will have to balance that with a very firm position on the violence. And he has made it very clear that while he's open to talks and negotiations, he is not going to just give in to certain pro-Russian separatist terrorist elements in the East, as they would see it in Kiev.
That balance you mentioned there is key, though. On the one hand, he's talked of offering a weapons amnesty in the East, but he is also, obviously, to please his constituents in the West, talk about taking a hard line on people responsible for violence. sense. Is he a unifying figure, though? Does he have the popular regard in the East that Yanukovych, whatever else you may have said about him, did have?
Well, time will tell. We will have to see, and we'll have to give him a bit of space to sort of prove his worth. The good thing is, as Mary said, this election, on the whole, seems to be legitimate. It seems to have conformed to excellent democratic norms and standards, according to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which was monitoring it, and that's a big boost because he does have legitimacy and he will be able to harness that to an effect of trying to be a conciliator if that's the course he really truly wants to go down. And we'll have to wait and see that.
I was struck as well by Russia's reaction to his election. And Mary Dejeski, I'll put this to you. I'm not sure whether I'm reading too much into the choice of language used by Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. He talked about his willingness to meet with representatives of Kiev. Not, I thought, perhaps significantly representatives of Ukraine.
Well, I think actually you're reading the right thing into it. Because ever since Yanukovych was toppled or fled, depending how you look at it, there has been no legitimate government in Kiev so far as the Russians were concerned. They refused to recognize the interim government, which was one of the whole problems in the background of what's been going on since Yanukovych left. So President Putin started out the week before the election by saying that Russia would be prepared to accept the result if it was generally reasonably conducted. That has now happened. And now we've got the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. And it's interesting, it's the foreign minister. This is somebody talking about Ukraine as a foreign country, not as a Russian territory, saying that Russians are prepared to go to Kiev to talk. And I do think that's significant. And of course, it's hopeful.
On the subject, though, sticking with you, Mary, of who recognises what, one of the other things that Poroshenko has said, and I suppose it's something he probably felt he had to say, but he said he would never recognise Russia's occupation of Crimea. That is a totally lost cause at this point, isn't it?
It is a totally lost cause, and the extent to which it's lost actually makes what President-elect Poroshenko says really almost meaningless. Yes, you say he has to say it. Of course he has to say it. But it's also a fact that not just the government, the new government in Kiev, but pretty much everybody in Europe and in Washington accepts that Crimea is lost.
Matthew Jameson, do you think, I mean, is there a possibility that there is a potential resolution here in a perhaps somewhat slightly shabby trade-off under which Ukraine grudgingly agrees to recognise Russia's acquisition of Crimea on the grounds that Russia stays out of East Ukraine?
Well, that's going to be a very, very difficult proposition to put to the Ukrainians because, of course, you know, it's a chunk of their territory, and they've had their territory violated and their sovereignty violated. So they're understandably very, very angry. Whether or not they're going to be able to accept the trade-off and instead then, you know, the trouble dies down in the East is going to be very hard. It's going to be a very bitter pill for them to swallow. I don't know if they will do that officially. I mean, I don't know if they would put that on the record that they would be willing to ever countenance conceding the annexation of Crimea. And this maybe have to be something that will be done behind closed doors if it's done at all.
On that front, though, to what extent do you think Russia and Ukraine kind of have guns at each other's heads at this point? Because the thing that struck me throughout this crisis is that Russia, unless they really are thinking in a much more lateral way than the rest of us, Russia surely doesn't want a civil war in Ukraine either.
Yes, exactly. And I think that that is why now we are starting to see pulling back from the brink and certain comments coming out of the Kremlin, like when Putin said that he would respect the vote, because that's the last thing they really want. And they've already inflicted a lot of damage on themselves economically. And I think that they want to try to now, you know, sort of ramp this down and cool the situation.
Is that your sense, Mary, that Russia's trying to back out of this somewhat at this point?
Yes, absolutely. I think that they're obviously intent on hanging on to Crimea. That is a done deed. But I also think that the element of fear and panic in the Kremlin has been hugely underestimated, both at the beginning when President Yanukovych fled without any warning really to anybody, including Moscow, who were essentially his patrons, and that their behaviour both in annexing Crimea and in appearing to threaten eastern Ukraine can be explained as much by fear in Moscow of complete disorder across Ukraine and jeopardising Russia's interests as it can be by any sort of aggressive intent by President Putin.
Okay, well, we shall move from Ukraine to a few places slightly closer to where we are now. Results were declared yesterday in last week's elections to the European Parliament. Now, for the EU's political establishment, they make somewhat uncomfortable reading. Here in the UK, the poll was topped by UKIP, best imagined as the political wing of a home county's golf club, who seek the UK's exit from the EU. And far-right parties also did depressingly well in France, Denmark, Hungary and the Netherlands, while in Belgium, the biggest vote went to a party who want to abolish Belgium. I'll ask you first, Matthew from Roussy, is this, and this has always been my suspicion with European elections especially, that they kind of seen by a lot of the electorate as a sort of padded environment in which they can throw a tantrum with no particular consequences in the real world?
Yes, that is a certain point that I think what you're seeing is a certain amount of protest. But I think it's something deeper than that. I think it's far more fundamental. I think what we're witnessing now with the rise of UKIP, which cut into the Tory vote, but it also cut in significantly to the Labour vote in the north, especially in places like Rotherham, where I was discussing with Mary, you're seeing a complete disillusionment with the state of domestic British politics, with the leaders that we have and the political parties. Part of the appeal of Farage, I think, is he's just so, whether or not you're agree with him, at least you can respect him because you believe that what he's saying, he really, really believes it. He passionately believes it and he has conviction. We don't have anything like that from Cameron or Clegg or Miliband. They represent the professionalization of the politics, of the apparatchiks. So I think people are sick and tired of that, but also people, there's a huge amount of inequality that has grown up in this country. And when you allow inequality to grow, you're going to have social consequences and the rise of social tensions, and we're seeing that now. So this is a failure of policy on the part of successive governments to instead of promoting equality, we have now got a country which is growing more and more apart, as we're seeing in these results.
Mary Dejewski, do you think that's right? Is this an insurrection against the political establishment, or is this just a statement by a certain percentage of the British population they just don't like foreigners very much?
Well, I think there is something of that in it, but I do agree with Matthew that it is an anti-establishment vote and that there is a big constituency in the UK on left and right which opposes the establishment, which is completely fed up, which feels that they've been treated very badly, going back to, indeed, to the Iraq war, to the banking crisis. There are a lot of things that they have over the establishment that they want to get out of their system, and I think that was reflected in this vote. But I also think that it's possible to exaggerate what happened, because when you actually look at the figures, turnout was 37%, I think, across the UK, and not significantly better across much of Europe. So when you're talking about UKIP and Farage taking the biggest slice of the vote in Britain, then it's the biggest slice of the vote, which was really quite small. So when you look across nationally, maybe it's not quite so much of an insurrection after all.
Is there a wider problem here, though? And I'm just wondering if this is another thing that these votes might be an expression of, that people are, and I speak as, you know, somebody who would classify themselves as such, not really sceptical about the EU, but really baffled by it. I mean, I speak as somebody who tries to take an interest both professionally and personally. I don't know who my MEP is. It might be one of you, for all I really know. And apologies if that's the case. And I hope I voted for you. But this is my point. I can't imagine how many people you would need to stop in the street in London before somebody could confidently answer that question.
Mm. Well, I think that, you know, part of this is of course, the fact that in this country we have an overwhelmingly Eurosceptic, if not outright anti-European media. Most of the major, you know, newspapers like The Times, The Telegraph, the sort of even, you know, Sky News and so on, they have been pushing a certain anti-European agenda. The Daily Mail, I mean, you just pick up the Daily Mail and there's a constant stream of propaganda. Anti-EU propaganda, ludicrous nonsense. Most of it is complete fantasy.
But is this nonetheless pandering to what is a largely Eurosceptic population?
Well, remember, at the end of the day, prejudice is ignorance. And so I feel as though the British people really, they have not been properly informed over the years about what's going on in Brussels. Of course, there's terrible graft and corruption, but that happens anywhere, in any parliament, in Westminster, in the expenses scandal. It's not unique to Brussels. So I think we need to do a much better job of pro-Europeans in this country of getting the real story out.
Mary Dejeski, are the British people ever going to like Europe, do you think, or like the idea of Europe?
Well, I think maybe it's a bit of an exaggeration to say that they actually don't like it quite as much as the impression we often have, because I think that when there was the first talk of a referendum, which Cameron's promised if the Tories get re-elected, then the polls actually started to shift because there was the beginnings of a real debate. And, for instance, business came out and said, look, this is going to be a catastrophe if we leave. In the last few weeks, there's been an American poll which suggested that there would be a 10% majority for staying in Europe if the vote were held in the next few weeks, which, of course, it's not going to. But I don't think that British opinion is so Eurosceptic as it's cracked up to be. And I also think it's prepared to bend that there are more, as it were, passive Europhiles out there than there are vocal Eurosceptics.
I suspect that may well be the case. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. I'll still be with Mary Dejeski and Matthew Jameson when we return. Up next, continuing with the theme of elections, we'll be looking at Egypt, where very few people will be staying up all night to see who wins.
Each year, the Pre-Pic Day honours photographers who pull focus on challenging environmental issues. Monocle Films reports on the alchemy of this year's images and explores their potential to affect change.
The still image has as much power as it ever had, in spite of the ubiquity of the printed image on the internet and films, videos and everything. I think this exhibition shows that single images can have as much raw power and emotion and can engage so strongly with the senses that you simply cannot forget them.
You can watch our report on the 2014 Prix Pic Day by heading to the film section at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's 1823 in London. You're listening to Monocle 24. Still with me is journalist Mary Dejeski, the chief editorial writer and columnist at The Independent, and Matthew Jameson, consultant fellow at London-based defence think tank RUSI. Now, Egyptians have been voting today for a new president, or perhaps more accurately, have been conferring a certain semi-spurious legitimacy on the man who helped himself to the job last July. Mary and Matthew, I will come to you in a moment, but first, our contributor Rebecca Collard sent us this report from the polls in Cairo.
The mood outside polling stations today in Cairo was oddly festive. Women chanted, clapped and cheered in a way typical of weddings and celebrations. The celebration, perhaps because most here are sure, former Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi will win today's vote. Less than a year ago, the ex-general el-Sisi deposed Egypt's first elected civilian president, Mohamed Morsi. As long as el-Sisi is with us, we are with him. One hand, says this voter. I am stronger and safer when I vote for el-Sisi. And while few here seem to know anything about el-Sisi's election platform, it's hard to find someone on the streets of Cairo who isn't voting for him. And posters of his only rival, liberal Hamdine Sabahi, are scant. At another polling station, there is one voter who cast his ballot for Sabahi. Yes, I voted for Hamdine Sabahi, he says. But before we can even finish our conversation, the crowd of LCC supporters becomes angry at his vote for the other guy. We're all forced to leave the polling station. After 3 years of revolution and uprising, some fear that the predicted victory for LCC marks Egypt's return to the military-backed authoritarianism the country lived under for decades, and that today's vote may simply be the election of Egypt's next dictator. For Monocle in Cairo, I'm Rebecca Collard.
Well, Rebecca did manage to find one Hamdine Sabahi voter there, but first of all, I guess, are we ruling out an upset here?
Yeah.
Well, okay then. Will there be any perceptible difference at all? And I guess this is an incredibly depressing coda to the Arab Spring. Will Egypt notice any difference whatsoever between al-Sisi and Mubarak?
Yeah, I mean, it feels very much like back to the future, really, because it's after the 2011 uprising and the beginning of the Arab Spring. Now we seem to be going back again to, instead of a democratic sort of experiment and trying to create a liberal democracy with pluralism and a multi-participatory political structures, now it seems to be gravitating back towards the strongman in the form of al-Sisi, you could see as a latter-day Mubarak. And I wouldn't be surprised if maybe that is what will happen and that is how this government will develop and it will become another sort of, you know, strong military government like Mubarak's.
Is that, or might that be, in fact, and an election would appear to be about to confirm that, is that perhaps, Mary Dejewski, what quite a lot of Egyptians want, or at least will settle for, as opposed to the chaos they've had over the last couple of years?
Well, yes, exactly. And I think when you used the word chaos, that was actually quite indicative. Because I think, you know, when you live in a West European country, which by and large doesn't descend into chaos, you tend to underestimate the attraction for people who live in conditions of threat and chaos of a stable regime, stability at almost any price. And I think that is what al-Sisi is offering after 2-3 years of complete turmoil. So you can understand why this is the best option, really.
Why do you think he's going through the, it's a charade to a certain extent, of having an election? Is this, I'm just wondering to what extent this is a bit of theatre to enable Egypt supporters in the West to go along with the idea that he's an elected president and not a military strongman who sees power by force, which, you know, obviously he is and he did.
I think there's an awful lot of acceptability to the West involved in this, especially in America, where they went through the whole very difficult process of disassociating themselves from Mubarak, supporting democracy in Egypt, then watching that democracy essentially dissolve and be overthrown. And so now there is degree of respectability, even if it's quite manipulated. So I think that is important. But I also think that it's probably important for al-Sisi himself. And we saw something similar in Pakistan a few years ago, that actually military men, always men, don't like to see themselves in power as military rulers. They want some greater legitimacy. And so they sort of restyle themselves as civilians. They hold elections to legitimize their position. And I think that in a way is more of a positive comment than a negative one, that it's no longer quite as acceptable as it used to be a military man in power.
Matthew Jameson, is this basically an anything for a quiet life vote by Egypt's people?
Yes, I mean, I agree with Mary in the sense that, you know, they've been going through a terrible upheaval. There's been absolute turbulence and there's been, you know, little security. So whenever your state is crumbling and there is all sorts of terrible things going on and you live in chaos, you want a strong leader and you want stability. So in a way, you know, it's understandable why the Egyptian people have flocked to al-Sisi. It's a pity because in the long run, democracy is the really only way to go if you want to bring about long-term prosperity and also long-term stability. But unfortunately, you know, it's going to take many, many decades for Egypt to get to that point. You just don't build a democracy overnight.
We will unfortunately have to leave it there. Mary Dejewski and Matthew Jameson, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our man in Montreal, talking art in Berlin and much more besides. Ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thanks very much. At least 40 people have been killed and 150 more injured in a train crash in the Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. The accident happened when an express passenger train ran into a stationary goods train near a station 150 miles from the state capital, Lucknow. The man who killed six people in a California college town emailed his deadly plans minutes before he went on a rampage, sending his parents racing to try to stop him. The 22-year-old, Elliot Roger, stabbed three people to death in his flat before gunning down three more victims on Friday night in Santa Barbara. The FIFA president Sepp Blatter has met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and the head of the Palestinian Football Association Jibril Rajoub today ahead of next month's FIFA Congress when Palestinians said they would urge delegates to take sanctions against Israel. And stunning victories in European parliamentary elections by nationalist Eurosceptic parties from France and Britain has left the European Union licking its wounds on Monday and facing a giant policy dilemma. Across the continent, anti-establishment parties more than doubled their representation. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House, live here from Studio One on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro, and roughly halfway between. It's 18:32 here in London. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're going to Montreal, where our correspondent Patrick Pittman awaits with the latest headlines in Quebec. Patrick, first of all, a Quebecois triumph at Cannes, I understand.
Yes, the very young Xavier Dolan, only 25 years old, took out the jury prize at Cannes, sharing it with Jean-Luc Godard.
What film has won this prize for him?
It's a very personal film that's called Mummy, at least that's the English title of it, and people have just been going crazy about it over there from what I hear, although one of the local papers here this morning reported it as him not winning the Palme d'Or, which I thought was a little harsh.
What is it that has resonated with people about this film?
From what I understand, it's a very strange and joyous and challenging, almost Oedipal film about a relationship between a mother and her son that goes a lot of strange places. And the thing about Dolan's films is they're always so enthusiastic and people really love them.
We should move along to another story you flagged up, which is it's one of those kind of it would be funny if it wasn't true Montreal corruption stories. Introduce to us, if you would, the McGill University Health Centre.
So the McGill University Health Centre is one of the two major health institutions in Montreal. It's been undergoing a massive construction project for new premises now for years and years. It's $115 million in deficit, scheduled to open next year. But its CEO, Arthur Porter, well, he was the CEO until recently, is just a larger-than-life figure who's currently in prison in Panama awaiting extradition over extorting $22.5 million out of the process to funnel it to some questionable construction companies. All kinds of crazy things about this story. Porter himself was once the civilian overseer of Canada's spy network.
The phrase "larger than life" is very often a tactful euphemism disguising a multitude of sins. How did he get away with this for so long, or is that what people are trying to figure out now?
That's a very big question. I mean, in Montreal, business as usual is often somewhat slippery in its morality, but there are a lot of people asking questions about the board of this hospital who were signing off on some of the most ludicrous expense claims you've ever seen, including, you know, a leased Bentley with a $60,000 down payment, which the hospital covered, amongst other things. Look, nobody's got a good answer. There is a new board in charge at the hospital, but actually features many of the same members as the old board.
As you say, Mr. Porter is currently consuming prison gruel in Panama. Is anybody else being held accountable over this, or likely to be held accountable over this?
Well, the Charbonneau Commission, which we've touched on a few times, that's been ongoing in Montreal for a while now, looking at corruption in the construction industry, has actually turned its attention to the McGill University Health Center this week. So there's been a fair amount of new testimony and revelation going forward. And, you know, that commission has already taken down two mayors of Montreal and several construction executives. And they're not treading lightly. So it'll be interesting to see what the outcome is for the health center.
A reminder, I guess, that rambunctious success in Canada is not exclusively the province of Rob Ford, but we should move from local politics to national politics. How do you end up in a relatively civilized democracy like Canada with the Prime Minister and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in a state of more or less open warfare?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. The way the Supreme Court appointments work here is that there's a certain amount guaranteed to each province. And it's generally expected that, you know, those people would come from that province's legal system. But Stephen Harper, when he went to find a new Quebec justice, sort of found that there weren't really many conservatives on the bench here, Quebec being relatively progressive in its way. And so he had to stretch to find somebody that you might vaguely call a Quebec lawyer in Marc Nadon. And
He's got quite a French-sounding name.
He does, and he is of Montreal, but his practice hasn't been of this province at all, and he didn't, you know, none of the Quebec legal system recognizes him as anything other than a nice guy, but somebody that wasn't qualified for the job. And so reporting in the Globe and Mail this week sort of showed that they were really stretching to find anybody that could be considered a conservative appointment here, and the Supreme Court didn't in any way accept this and overturned the appointment, and the two institutions have been bickering ever since.
Is there a resolution in sight to this?
Well, not so far. Harper obviously has to appoint a new justice, and in fact, the other Quebec justice has also indicated he'll soon be retiring, being 75, so he's going to have to find two justices that he's happy with, and that will really be stretching it. And on the other side of things, the Supreme Court are standing up and saying that though they're not interfering in the appointment process, that being a political one, they're certainly not going to accept anybody that isn't qualified.
We should move finally along to the kind of story that we always end up reporting with a somewhat heavy heart. And this is the winding down of any print publication or its absorption into a non-physical form. La Presse, which is Montreal's most read French language broadsheet, is giving up on being a newspaper.
Yes, after a good 130 or so years, as probably the most progressive and activist of the French language newspapers here, and of any language of newspapers here. They've got a great history of reporting, but in the recent annual general meetings, their executives basically said, look, print's done, we're accepting it, we're going all digital. And you know, that doesn't leave a lot of strong French language reporting in print on the streets of Montreal.
Is this reflective of trends in Canadian publishing generally? Are all print newspapers across Canada struggling?
They are, as they are everywhere else. On the English language side in Montreal, you've got the Gazette, which is the sister paper to the Star in Toronto, and you know, they've obviously both been doing lots of good reporting lately. It's been a big part of the Rob Ford story. But circulations are obviously falling, but there is still a strong need for this. And the other issue with this in terms of Quebec and Montreal politics generally is that the other investigative reporting influence has been Radio Canada from the CBC, and they're also facing a lot of problems with budget cuts. So it's really, you know, struggling to find some strong investigative voices anymore.
La presse, I assume, are making all the optimistic noises that people always make in these circumstances about their digital future and how well they're going to adapt to the web and tablets and so on and so on and so on. You mentioned there specifically their investigative function. Is there widespread fear that that will be lost? Because one of the things that newspaper publishers all over the world have learned is that investigative journalism, and weirdly it seems to be the most expensive and difficult forms of journalism, are the ones that attract the least reader interest.
Absolutely. I think that is definitely a great fear. It's something that if you speak to any executive one-on-one about these things, they'll always say, no, we have to back our investigative reporting first. You know, I've spoken to people at Fairfax in Australia about that. But then the reality in a day-to-day sense of things is that that stuff is hard to do and only gets harder. And if you're trying to compete in a flashy tablet environment, it's really tricky to put that stuff up front. That said, the press has really gained a lot of respect. In those issues of Montreal corruption we were talking about earlier, their reporting has really been deeply influential in the city, and I think a lot of people would notice if it went.
One would hope so. Newspapers, people will miss them when they're gone. Patrick, thank you very much for that. That was Patrick Pittman, Monocle's man in Montreal. Up next, we'll be meeting the brains behind the Herb Lester City Guides.
As the votes are cast and counted across Europe, the Foreign Desk asks, how democratic is the world's richest continent?
There are still huge weaknesses in the democratic structure of Europe. The structure is so confusing and difficult to understand that I doubt if very many citizens know what on earth it's all about.
As Europe's powers have grown, so too has the gap between the decision makers and the rest of us. But can that change?
There is no fresh answer to the concerns and anxieties of European citizens, even in countries which are faring very well in economic and social terms.
We'll speak to academics and journalists on whether the EU has lost its way and ask voters on the continent what the institution means to them.
Hungary is such a little country. Yeah, and we want to have influence because we are really depending on the help from some of the big countries like Germany, and I don't think we can handle it alone.
That's Democracy in Europe, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk, with me, Steve Bloomfield, here on Monocle 24.
From coat hooks to ceramics, cooking utensils to kettles, satisfying solutions are to be found in Monocle's roundup of simply designed and endlessly useful things.
When Lee Stewart and Kailash Parmar met in London, they set out to design the Crash Bang Wallop hanging shelves. Inspired by suspended kitchen utensils, the design stems from the idea of framing the objects within the shelf.
Objects of Desire, a slideshow featuring Monocle's top 25 home helpers, now showing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24. It's 1842 in London. When they wearied of traditional tourism guides, Ben Ollins and Jane Smiley decided they needed to create something new for those looking to discover the more unusual aspects of a city. They created the fictional character of Herb Lester, their alleged boss, a man with rarefied tastes who demanded to travel in style. And so Herb Lester Associates were born. Herb Lester's maps describe the usual and the unusual parts of a city, guiding visitors through the world's great conurbations. Ben and Jane sat down with Daphne Denis to discuss their work in general and their newest book in particular, A Guide to London Pubs.
We started together, you know, we both had a kind of an interest in visiting places and we're curious about places, and I think we felt the same that when you go somewhere you want to have an experience that's particular to that place, and that's quite hard to do because so many things are so similar wherever you go. But we wanted to create these guides that gave you more of a sense of what the place is like, what is special that you can see and do there. Not necessarily, you know, trying to say, well, this is the 30 or 40 best things, but all of these things are, if you do them here, you have a good time and it won't be quite like what you do when you're at home.
So we've got a book here, sort of your new book, which is about London pubs. So quite a local thing here. But you've done maps about lots of different places. When do you make a book and when do you decide to just do a map? Or is there always...
Well, this is our first book. So that question will become easier in a few years' time, I think. I mean, there are thousands of London pubs. We've done a London pub guide, a small guide. It's a subject you can keep exploring. We could probably do another, you know, two or three London pub books if we chose to. Not that that's a plan, but this first one would do.
So why did you decide to make this one into a book? Just because it couldn't possibly fit into a map?
Well, it started as a map, and Ebury Press approached us about expanding and making it into a book. And it's, as Ben says, it's a really rich subject, and there are lots of pub guides for London around, and there are lots of really good ones, but there aren't any that are quite like this, that categorise pubs in the way that we have. And
it's actually quite hard going through pub guides, because they're usually done by area, and everything sounds pretty good. And so we're trying to make it actually easier to find stuff that, you know, because there are fewer entries, that one thing that makes it simpler, you know, same goes with all our stuff. Because we've given these chapters, which are occasions, so, you know, because particularly, you know, you've got a dog.
So just for an example, you give it like when you need a place to hide.
Yeah. Or if you want to be alone, or if you, you know, as a Patrick Hamilton section. So if you really love Patrick Hamilton books and you want to sit in a really, really mournful pub in the middle of the West End on a Wednesday afternoon with the rain beating against the windows, these are the place to do it. You're not really going to get that specific a recommendation in other books. It's a different way of looking at this vast array of pubs in the city.
So what way do you approach, let's talk about your other maps as well. What way do you like approach a city like San Francisco? I'm just saying that because this is the map that's sitting in front of me. How do you decide I'm going to say something completely different from what's been said before when it's such a touristic and different city that, you know, people have talked about over and over again?
Well, I think sometimes there are specific themes. So for our New Orleans map, it's very much about having a good time, eating and drinking, indulging. And so that's very much the focus. Manhattan bars, it's pretty obvious what that one focuses on. Some of them, like the San Francisco map, are more general. And I guess the point of them is that we touch on some of the more touristy type things. We try to give a really varied experience of the city. So we pick out things that are particularly good in San Francisco or things and places that are unexpected. And we hope that as a group of places and experiences, they add up to something which gives you a really interesting overview of the city and allows you to have a really good time.
What was different about making this book from what you've done before? What was, you know, how has the experience been different this time around?
There's a great deal more legwork. You know, you've got to kiss a lot of frogs. And so we went to a lot of pubs that weren't very nice, drank a great deal of lime and soda at 11:30 in the morning, thinking it'd be nice to come back here. The scale of it was much greater. With something like, you know, distinctly San Francisco, we were just looking for things that we felt, this is distinct to San Francisco, you'd be unlikely to find it anywhere else. With London pubs, you're sort of juggling, trying to find great pubs, but also trying to find things that work for occasions. So there are pubs we really like that didn't go in. It's just on a much larger scale. And also, because it's a book which will probably reach more people, trying to talk to people who don't necessarily know the kind of prism, the Herb Lester prism, how we see things, or how he sees things. And so that's the challenge of it. And then, you know, it's getting rid of places that you really like, that you'd like to put in and just think there isn't room or it doesn't fit. We didn't do anything so selfish to say, I really like this place and it's too good for the general public. Or, you know, lots of favourites are in there too, but there's a lot to juggle. It's a big, big editing job.
So going back to Herb Lester that you just mentioned there, he's your boss. He's someone that apparently you think his name reflects the taste of the places that you recommend in your maps and now your book. How can we define his taste? I know he's quite discreet, as you were saying, but...
He's just someone who's very curious. He's the sort of person who isn't afraid to push on a door that's half open if he thinks the place looks interesting inside. He's also not going to judge it because it has or doesn't have particular things. So it's not so simple as to say any chain is bad or he's only looking for the very best coffee. He's open to stuff. Does it you know, beguile him? And that is really, we have this tagline, the usual and unusual. And that's what's really important to us, that And you know, to the character of Herb Lester, it's what's really worth seeing and doing. You know, what if I go here, will I have a good time? And that's kind of what's on his mind. Will it be fun? Will it be interesting? Will it be something I can tell people about?
So how did you come up with that name?
something's just happened. We just talked about it a lot, and
it's hard to really remember. It just happened one day.
Do you have other book projects then? Other, you know, subjects that you feel are wide enough that you would like to make a book about them?
I think we do have some books that we'd like to do. We don't have any imminent plans for another one yet. This one's only been out for a couple of weeks. So we have quite a few more guides in the pipeline for this year. And I think we'd like to do another book at some point if we could agree on what the right topic would be.
We've got ideas for books and for more guides. And we've got a lot of things we'd like to do. We've got titles for things we don't even know what they are. So something else will happen. But yeah, for the moment, you know, London Pub February occasion is the one we're focusing on.
That was Daphne Denis talking to Ben Ollins and Jane Smiley from Herb Lester Associates. Their book, A London Pub for Every Occasion, is out now. It's time now for a song. We're going to stay more or less on the theme established by the previous item, and you can thank me at this point for overruling the House Martins happy hour. This is Pet Shop Boys with West End Girls.
Sure, we've got no past here today, built to last in every city and every nation, from Lake Geneva to the Finland Station.
Years old last month, West End Girls by the Pet Shop Boys. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's coming up for the end of the show on Monday. It's time now to review the best and sometimes the worst in the world of cinema, TV, theatre, music and more. Today we're talking art. Monocle contributor Melanie Shevchenko joins us now from Berlin to talk us through three exhibitions. Melanie, welcome to the show. Three really interesting exhibitions you've picked on for us to talk about. I wanted to start with Nick Novak's Echo Drones, mostly because it appears to have very small tanks in it.
Yes, that's true. Well, they're not small tanks, but they're actually small drones. Nick Novak, he's an artist that's based in Berlin now, and his show is called Echo Drones, and it's currently exhibiting at the Berlinish Gallery. So Echo, it's a sound installation that fills almost the entire bottom of the Berlinish Gallery. So it's melding art, science, and technology. So typically his projects investigate strategies for filling space acoustically. So what Nick Novak has done here is he's created two autonomous robot drones. And these drones move freely through the gallery space. So they're actually programmed to recognize visitors and then monitor their movements. So for example, once I've got a drone's attention, then he'll follow me around the room.
And are these drones as in the airborne variety or the land cruising type?
They're the land cruising type, and actually their history comes from the drones that were actually made by U.S. forces. During the Second World War, some of the tanks were actually converted into something called Sonic M10. So instead of guns, these tanks would actually have drones attached to the tanks, and they were fitted with loudspeakers, and coming from those speakers would be, let's say, the sounds of an engine noise or warfare. And so the idea was to kind of throw the enemy, like a psychological warfare.
That's Nick Novak's Echo Drones exhibition at the Berlinische Gallery Museum of Modern Art. You also want to talk about the Dorothy Iannone retrospective.
Yes, that's correct. It's also at the Berlinische Gallery, and it's called The Sweetness Outside of Time. Dorothy Iannone was born in Boston in the early 30s, but she's actually lived and worked in Berlin since the 1970s. So this is a retrospective of, I guess, basically an overview of her work in what is called the erotic avant-garde. She encompasses her greatest theme, which is something she likes to call ecstatic love. So the retrospective is paintings with lots of text on the actual paintings, visual narratives, self-made books, videos. And altogether, they represent her as a pioneer of women's sexual and intellectual emancipation, particularly in the 1960s.
I did want to ask, how well or otherwise do you think her work from the 1960s has held up?
Well, you know, that's what's funny. It's a little bit quirky because it's a little bit dated, and it's kind of obvious. So there's a very, like, kind of hippy-dippy psychedelic feel to it, but I think that also adds to its charm. And she's definitely very, very talented. So you have a lot of intricate details and a lot of humor involved in it, too. For example, not only her paintings, but she also makes small wooden statues of celebrities. And these celebrities have visible genitalia, for example. So she makes that on Charlie Chaplin or Jacqueline Kennedy, which is actually harkening back to her interest in sort of African tribal too. And basically, one more interesting fact about her is that during the 60s and 70s, and even as late as the 80s, she was actually censored quite a lot because her works tend to be considered pornographic. Yeah.
We need to move along finally and regrettably briefly to Ai Weiwei's huge show, Evidence, which is part of Festspiele.
Yes. Well, it's been garnering a lot of attention, and rightfully so. It's one of his, well, it's billed basically as his largest exhibition, solo exhibition, and the works were actually made specifically for Berlin and specifically for the space. So it covers 3,000 square meters in the Martin Gropius Bau in 18 different rooms. The exhibition is called Evidence, and it's a political exhibition, so he touches on several topics which at the moment are most important to him. And those topics tend to be freedom of information, freedom of speech, and expression. And also he looks at how we determine the real significance of history and civilization. But he's from Beijing, and he was detained about 3 years ago by Chinese authorities in an unclosed location in Beijing, and he was confined for 81 days. So a lot of the work in Evidence is really influenced by his stay in solitary confinement. And so he's recreating his cell. He's making documentaries. He's making music videos. He's making sculptures. So a lot of that has to do with his own political subversive attitude and also his political, what he feels is like a political prisoner in his own country.
Melanie, we will have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, Melanie Sevchenko in Berlin. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to our guests, Mary Dajewski from The Independent, Matthew Jamieson from RUSI. Also to today's producer, Daniel Giacopelli, researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Harriet Baker, and our studio manager, Bill Luti. I'll be back with Emma Nelson for The Daily at 2200. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.